Hey, welcome to Scott Capurro's podcast, Scott Capurro Probes. This week, I was lucky enough to work in Germany, first in Berlin for two nights at an English-speaking comedy event at Quash Comedy Club. And then we took a train to Dusseldorf and did an English-speaking comedy night there. The first in this venue, and maybe in Dusseldorf, for all I know. But I was lucky enough to be working with a brilliant German comedian, Christian Schulz-Lau. He performs all over the world, including the UK. He's incredibly famous in Germany. He's not only helping organize the events, but hosting them. He's 6'7", or 2 meters, if you're British or German. He's a giant and lovely and incredibly warm and fantastic on stage. Crowds go wild. And he's really good friends with my husband as well. He plays the club my husband works in London all the time, Top Secret Comedy Club. He plays the Comedy Store in London. He plays all over. And we had a great chat on the train from Berlin to Dusseldorf, which is why you hear some announcements from the German lady who was hosting the train ride. She's so sexy. And I left everything in because it's all part of the wild tapestry we call comedy. There are also some clips of Christian's work. Two clips before the interview begins of his comedy, so you can get a taste of what he does. And then a couple of other brief live performance clips within the interview, which we reference. Anyway, enjoy yourself. I did. He's fantastic. And tune in next week for who knows what.
And we have the Americans, obviously. Yes, fantastic. We love your country. We love Americans, don't we?
Yes!
Yes, we don't, apparently. So,
But you love me.
But I love you? No. It's like, you know what? Yeah, I'll tell you what I like. I love your flag. I think the American flag is my favorite flag in the world, you know? No offense, the Union Jack is great, you know? The German flag is okay, you know? But the American flag, come on, 50 little stars on your flag. And as we all know, each star represents one major conflict you started. And that coming from a German guy. No stars on our flag.
When women go out, British women go out, it's crazy too. They get naked as the night progresses. Like, they start wearing the full gear when they go out, and like nice shoes and heels and beautiful. And then every hour they would take off an item of clothing. And then at one point the shoes get uncomfortable, don't they? And then they start walking like this. That's the best part. When you pull and when you bring a British woman back to your hotel room, you know, you don't have to undress her. She's done that already. As a German, I do appreciate the efficiency. Saves me a lot of work.
Hey, podcast listeners. Welcome to Scott Capurro Probes. I'm in Germany where, yes, they laughed. It's fine. Anyway, right? I'm here.
Some did.
Yeah, a couple. With Christian Schulz-Lau.
Yeah,
Schulz-Lau. Schulz-Lau.
Pretty good.
I thought it was Schultz, but it's not. It's Schulz-Lau. L-O-H, but the H makes the O-O, right?
My own British agent thinks it's Schulz-Lau, so I think we're good.
We're doing some shows together in Berlin and Dusseldorf. I only say it like that because my ex-management used to pronounce it that way. Because there was a gig in Dusseldorf years ago.
Yeah.
They're trying to book me into. And every time she called me, she'd be like, there's a gig in Dusseldorf. So that's the impression that the British give of the German accent, that it's not sexy at all. But it is, but we'll talk more about that in a bit.
Right.
Christian is a stand-up comic who's very popular all over. But he's huge in Germany and in Britain does very well, but he started in 2002 as a comedian,
right?
In South America?
I started in Belgium.
In Belgium.
I did a semester abroad,
right?
As part of the Erasmus program, which was funded by the European Union, something that a lot of British students also enjoyed.
Oh, yeah.
Until last month.
A way to make friends right away. Right. All right, so yeah, they didn't like that, British, so they got rid of that. But, that's probably an old war thing. But
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
So you got... did you do a course in comedy or something?
No, I just started. I went to a club. The club was in Dutch, because in that part of Belgium, they speak Dutch.
Uh-huh.
And then I asked
them... The nice
them,
part of Belgium.
Right, yeah, they the rich part. They're funding the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
The French are kind of like just, you know.
Lazy.
They're a burden, yeah.
Yeah, they're a burden, yeah. Cute, though.
Yeah, yeah, great, great culture. Anyway, so they, I asked them after the gig if I could perform there in English, and they said, have you ever done it? And I said, yeah, of course, many times, which was a lie.
Yeah.
So my career started with a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, they gave me 7 minutes, and that was my first ever gig.
7 minutes for your first?
7 minutes, yeah. How long was yours?
Probably like, yeah, like that. I mean,
it's a long time, right? 7 minutes when you have nothing.
It's a definite trickle of sweat down your back if it's not going well. That's definitely that. And the, and that trickle goes really, really slow. And I think also you're not used to hearing your voice in a large room.
Right. It wasn't that large.
All right. Well, I mean, in any room where people are just looking at you, looking in your direction, it's just, it's not a normal form of discourse.
Right.
Usually people are responding verbally.
To avoid that, I thought I had this great idea for my first gig. I faced them with my back, so I turned the other way, looked at the wall, and I started my set like that. And
then, terrible idea.
Terrible
idea. Yeah. Because it's better when the audience, I'm just saying, because it's better when the audience can see your face, I think.
Oh, yeah, it was a terrible idea. Stupid. I've obviously never done it since.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I didn't get anything for that idea and that joke that I did. And then I turned around and I introduced myself properly and I said that I was a German comedian and then they started laughing.
All right.
But also that wasn't the plan. I didn't want them to laugh at the fact that I'm a German comic.
Did they laugh, do you think, because they didn't believe that comedy in Germany existed?
Yeah, yeah, that old cliche.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, but I kind of like, I was like, oh, okay, why not use it, you know?
Yeah. This show, by the way, this podcast is, I like to have people on whose work I admire because anyone who speaks publicly.
But they weren't available today.
Yes, exactly. Okay. You were the best I could do at this price range.
Right.
And, no, because you were on the train, it happened. So I was going to do something else, but I didn't make the train, right? No, but anyone who speaks publicly... Oh, God, here we go. About... Do we have to pause this? About themselves, like politicians, writers, and comics. It's been mostly comics so far, but... And I asked them why they told that joke or did that bit. What inspired them to do what they do, you know?
Right.
Not stand-up per se, but a particular bit.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that that's the way you decided to start your act. And I wonder if you decided to start your act that way because you were you shy when you had your back to the audience? Did you think, I just can't look at them at first, I just need a minute on stage to myself? Or did you just think this is a clever idea no one's ever done before?
Yeah, like I think I was always been obsessed with breaking rules, you know? I was like, I think it might be my Germanness, like that I've always hated rules. And I feel like it's just like people are, there's just too many rules. We're dominated by rules and kind of like regulations.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought, I want to have a different approach. And then I realized, no, you have to learn your craft first until you can break the rules, you know? And I obviously had no idea.
Yeah,
like... So I broke rules that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah, like Picasso had to learn how to draw first.
Yeah, he was great. When he started doing, like, abstract stuff, he had already painted, like, beautiful, kind of very realistic paintings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he did all that shit where he fucked people's faces up.
Yeah, yeah.
So after that, you went to South America?
Yeah, this was still during university, right? And then I finished university and I did some gigs on the side.
So what's your degree in? Sorry, what did you get?
Media management.
It was
So the first
that sounds like a kind of
useless bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, it's bullshit.
Absolutely
bullshit
useless
degree. Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. Luckily, I have never used it. So,
yeah. Maybe you do unintentionally with your work, with promoting yourself.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah, I know how to write a tweet and where it goes and how it technically.
Well, that was worth it.
Yeah, well. Anyway, so I finished university and I did comedy on the side. So I always did because the first gig went quite well and the promoter said, we're going on a little tour through Holland and Belgium, in Dutch, obviously. We would like to have one exotic guy on the bill.
After your first 7 minutes?
After my first 7 minutes. Tour? And they said, we're going to pay you like 30 euros or so per gig and we put you up and pay for your beers. And that's where they sold the whole thing, you know, like, we're going to pay for your beers. Belgian beers, great. So I did that little mini tour and then I was hooked. And then I did that on the side and I went back from Germany to Belgium once in a while to do gigs. Finished university, started work, and on the side still did stand-up. But very, like, it wasn't very regular. It was just once every 6 weeks, maybe. Not enough.
Right.
And then many years later, I gave up my day job and then I...
What was your day job?
I was a game show producer for television.
That's a cunt too, right? Well,
fun. It was silly.
Really? What was the game show? What's this game show in Germany late at night where someone gets punched in the face with a boxing glove? They're sitting in a chair and they get the question wrong. They're punched hard from side to side by a red boxing glove. And there's a man and a woman hosting the show standing there laughing at him. And they do slow motion of his face getting punched really hard.
Sounds like you're describing your sexual fantasy.
It's a fetishy show.
Yeah.
And it's a red boxing glove that, boom, right in the face.
That's a German show. I've never seen it. Wow. It sounds a bit more Austrian, like really weird. And dark stuff is always
Austrian. Oh, it's the Austrians, the weird ones.
Or Danish, yeah. Yeah. It's always the neighbors.
Blame them, yeah. Fucking Austrians. Anyway,
Well, I didn't produce that game show.
I think the brilliant thing about German history... is how they've convinced the world that... or Austrian history, sorry. Austrians have convinced the world...
How could you get those two confused?
Sorry, I forget. Yeah, but Austrians have convinced the world that Hitler was German and that Germany lost the war.
Right.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
God, their strategy is...
Well, incredible. He was born, like, literally on the border in Braunau, which is, like, it's really right by the border.
Yeah.
So it was They could just draw the... border around his house.
Oh, right. It's
been easier.
Oh, right.
And then, so, yeah.
So you're building the border for the growth of Hitler. Is that what you're doing? You're building the border.
They might have changed the border after he was dead, you know?
Oh, all right. They might have.
Yeah, they
gave it back to Germany.
Yeah.
That's a nice idea. That's sweet, actually.
Yeah. So they tried to do the same thing with Mozart's house, but that was too far in.
Oh, right. Way too far in. Give it to the French. You did your thing. And were you enjoying doing stand-up, even though it was...
I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
It's just the way you mentioned, the way you described it, you weren't doing enough. It's hard when you leave it for a while and go, even just a few weeks ago, back to it. Was that difficult for you?
I think it's easier when you start, right? When you start out, I turned over a lot of material. So I was like, I did stuff, and then I kind of abandoned a lot of it, and I wrote like a new 7 or 10 minutes, and which is stupid because you should hone your jokes, right?
Yeah.
As we do now, but like then I thought, like, I've got this idea, why not try that out? And then I think I had like I was quite productive, and I wasn't afraid of failure because I had nothing to lose, because I had nothing, you know,
there was
no
career
or no pressure. And then later when I kind of like tried to make a living from stand up, that was then in London, I was like, I now need to really have the perfect 10 minutes, you know, and then the perfect 20, and that was different. So I think in the beginning I felt very free. I always tell young people that start out, like, enjoy it, you know, because you can feel free. It's gonna
And you have to give yourself the freedom to fuck up when you're young, make mistakes, and figure out where the mistakes are. I mean, I think that's part of the problem we were talking earlier about, how we hone our jokes down almost to the bare minimum because we want to be funny all the time on stage, but we forget that there are details along the way with that story or that gag that you've discarded that were actually really charming, warm details that give the audience a chance to know who you are. I remember when I first started, it's a bit of a...
What year did you start? You started in the 90s?
The 1890s. And the wheel was invented. No, I started I was like you. I did it at university a bit, just for fun. I took a comedy course, and I'd done a bit...
This is a very important question, an interesting question. Would you recommend taking a comedy course to people who want to start?
If you
comedy?
Could take it from the guy, I took it from Stuart Duckworth, a British actor who was hilarious. And I was getting a drama degree anyway, so I was performing a lot. And if you're comfortable on stage, if you've already worked that out for yourself, then yes, somebody who can watch you and say, oh, you might... And get feedback from other performers. I wouldn't suggest a comedy course to someone who's never been on stage before. I think there's so much you have to work out for yourself that way first, that a course is almost too soon. I think if you want to do comedy, throw yourself on stage 50 times, and then if you're not finding a way to write your jokes, you can't find your voice, then take a course.
No, stop doing comedy.
No.
But if you've done it 50 times and you don't, it's not working.
All right, 15.
Yeah, right, okay. Yeah. But I think
I don't want anyone to do comedy anymore because there's enough.
There's too many.
Yeah, there's way too many.
And I feel I think the most valuable kind of like pieces of advice were in the beginning, especially when you get with experienced comics, you just ask them one thing at a time. You know, you just you ask this guy or this. Well, there's some female acts now as well, right?
Yeah, there are some. Yeah, right. Yeah. One or two. Right. I wouldn't ask them anything. They'll get very, very, very prickly if you ask them questions.
Well, that's just you then.
Yeah, you can't comment on their appearance. Yeah, they get very nervous about that. Even if you tell them they look good, they're like, did I look bad before? I'm like, I don't.
Yeah, and also don't kind of reduce me to my looks, you know? Like,
I'd love someone to objectify me. When you get, I tell everybody, when you get older, you really miss that.
Yeah.
So enjoy while it's happening.
But I was like, I asked every like really experienced comic that I met for one piece of advice at a time. And I thought that was really helpful. And I watched them, you know. Apparently, like our friend Dave Thompson told me this. when he was in the 90s.
Which Dave Thompson? Which personality?
The daytime Dave Thompson,
the nighttime, or the breakfast time Dave Thompson?
He's
a complicated figure, that Dave
Thompson. Yeah.
A lot of voices in his head.
This was around late afternoon, I would say.
Oof.
So he was between... reading a book,
right,
and running a sex party.
Right. All right, good. So there's now, a lull in that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
A quiet moment.
So I caught him in that perfect moment.
Running a sex party.
And he said that when he was much younger, like so in the early 90s, I think, he did a gig regularly that was run by Sacha Baron Cohen's father.
Fantastic.
And Sacha would be sitting in the front row.
He used to go see a lot of comedy, actually.
Yeah, and he watched every night, and he studied the comedians.
Yeah.
And he was a kid or a teenager at the time.
Yeah.
And so obviously he must have been terrified by Dave's jokes, by some of Dave's jokes. And then Dave talked to him afterwards. He said, look, you're here all the time, you know? Do you want to be a comedian too? And then he said, yeah, I'm studying it. I want to know how it works. I want to find the formula. And I think, so that's a great comedy course.
Yeah, that's just watching people.
Yeah, watch people who are good at it.
It always alarms me when I go to do a gig, and I don't mean that I'm any great shakes, but I've done it for quite a while. And like I did the gig in Central London a couple weeks ago, and there were three comics on before me that were new, and right before I went on, they left. And I said to the promoter, I don't care what they do and how they find their way, but I just think it's unusual. Mm. Were I them, I would want to stay and watch just the first few minutes, just how someone who's been around for a while starts their bit.
Because
that can be the hardest for new people. It's most unnerving. But anyway, I think that's right. I think watching and asking and talking with people that you admire. Because I know that Sasha used to come see a lot of stuff because he saw me there a couple of times. And I only know that because friends of mine that met him at a dinner party years later, once he was famous, they mentioned that they knew me because they were comedians that had worked in the UK, and he said, oh yeah, I know that guy, he's funny. So I know that he had seen me there.
Okay.
There's no way he would have seen me since he's been somebody.
Yeah. You never know, like you see at the Comedy Store in London, you see famous people
you do,
who watch
the
show.
They pop in, they do. But I just think it's unusual the way you did. Like you took a great amount of time when you first started, didn't you?
Yeah.
Is it because you were doing other jobs, other things, obviously, but is it also because you weren't sure that this is what you wanted your occupation to be? Were you not 100% committed to making this your life? Is that what it was?
No, I was 100% committed. When I was a teenager, I wanted to be a comedian. When I was a kid, I think I wanted to be a comedian.
But where did you get that? Because what's the history of alternative comedy like in Germany? Was there a role model, or were you watching American comedians, or who were you watching?
Both. So first German comedians, but it wasn't like such a big thing at the time. You know, in Germany there was comedy, obviously. There's always been comedy, and there's always been like stand-up, but it wasn't that big scene and that like it is now, or like it used to be or like it has been in Britain. Or
was there someone in your town where you grew up that you thought was funny that you thought?
No, not really, but like. But it was like I listened to records and I watched stuff on TV and like on tapes, and then I got my hands on like recordings from America. Like those were like audio cassettes that I bought in a comic book shop. They had imported stuff, and that was Margaret Cho and a few others, you know, from America.
She's brilliant. Yeah.
So I listened to that and I was like, oh wow, that's great. I didn't understand everything, but I thought this is great. This is what I want to do. And
your English was good enough at that time that you understood the innuendo and all.
Yeah, I got most of it. Yeah, not everything. And then I was like, oh, well, this is great, you know. And I started writing bits probably when I was like 16 or so. Mm-hmm. And I never went on stage because I was a bit afraid. And also, I'm from a rather conservative background, so I was like, I know I need to go to university and have a job first. It would be such a big cut to become a freelance artist, you know, or comedian or whatever, a stage artist, because that's. That wasn't in our dictionary at home,
right.
You know, that word. And so I knew I needed to go like a conventional way, you know, before I...
First.
But I always had that plan. I was like, I knew I would want to do
even
that.
Even when you were working on the game show?
Yeah, of course.
What was the game show? What was the plot of the game show?
It was different stuff, but it was like I worked for a production company that was in charge of certain... It was an international company, multinational company, and we produced game shows for many different countries.
All right.
And I was one of the producers there. And it was good fun. And I did that.
Did you meet comedians through that?
I didn't meet many comedians, no. But some of the presenters that we had used to do, well, they did stand-up as well. And then I did stand-up on the side. And then I went to South America to produce game shows there. And I did stand-up there in Spanish, which was, again, a new approach.
All right.
And then I...
So at this point, you had performed stand-up in German, English, and Spanish.
Yeah, but German very little, because I was focusing on the English, because that's how I started the whole thing. And then later, I quit the whole thing And I was like, now I need to, because I realized if you do a day job, you can't perform at night and make it a career. So my gigs were going well. The ones I did on the side, I think I could, I'm potentially funny enough to make a living. Maybe, if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
And then I gave up everything and I went to do the Edinburgh Festival. I did a solo show there.
What year was that?
2009.
This is before you had done...
I'd never been to the UK to do comedy. And I started with my solo show at the Fringe.
Where were you? What room were you in?
I was at the Dragonfly, just off Grassmarket, and it was a free show.
What time?
3 or 4 p.m.
Hilarious.
And I got the first night, I got like 10 people in. I was flyering all day. Got like 10 people in. And then it was picking up a bit. And like after a few days, I had 50. And the show got better.
Right.
And I was like, oh.
How was it the first night? How was the show? Was that your first hour?
I had done 2 previews in Budapest.
The best place to do it.
Hungary.
Yeah, of course. That would be anyone's plan.
Yeah.
And then how did it go? I mean, how'd your first hour go? Because the hour is so much longer than a 20-minute set.
Yeah, I know. It's so long. But
interminable if you haven't done it before.
Not long ago, I found the set list and I looked at it again because I don't have a recording of it. And I was like, some of the bits were good. Some of them were very mediocre, I thought, now looking back. But it kind of worked.
But memorizing it and the stress of going under it the first time, wasn't it just...
Yeah, I didn't do an hour the first day. I did like 40. And I called it an hour.
Right.
And then the second day, I did 43 maybe.
Right.
And by the end
which
of
is the, also long.
Yeah, it's very long, yeah. But if you say hello really slowly in the beginning, that's already...
When was the first time when you did it, you thought, okay, that was good? I remember the first time I did stand-up where I thought, okay, I'm going to sit in my car now after that and pat myself on the back because that went well.
Mm. That was probably...
And that was when I was like pretty much starting out in like 1993.
How long was that set that you had done?
Probably only 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah. I think there was a good 10-minute set at one point, like maybe 2 years after I'd started, where I felt like this now had, like the whole momentum was the right momentum, you know. But then that Edinburgh changed a lot because I met a lot of comedians and a lot of promoters at the Fringe because, you know, that's where everybody is. And then people booked me for their compilation shows and then they kind of, like a lot of people had the feeling they discovered me as a new act. But I had been doing stand-up for 7 years, just not often. So I kind of knew what I was doing.
When you were doing Spanish in Argentina, I guess, How did you write jokes? I mean, you speak Spanish fluently, obviously. You do.
Yeah.
But how did you enjoy performing in Spanish?
Yeah, I loved it because it was new to them. They didn't have much stand-up.
Right.
And I am obviously the perspective of a 6'7" or 2 meter tall ginger blondish, very white guy from Germany talking about Argentina and South America and their dynamics between Argentinians and Bolivians and the Chinese who run the supermarkets and all that kind of stuff. They obviously found that like very fascinating.
And why did you walk away from that? Why did you go to the UK then? Why did you leave there?
I was there for 3 years to do that TV stuff, and then I kind of like wanted to go back, and I knew I wanted to be a comic. My goal was always to perform at the Comedy Store in London.
All right.
Because I was there as a teenager when I was 16, and I stood in front of it, and I'm like, this is the place. One day,
all right,
I want to perform here. So, and that then.
Where did that idea land in your head? Why the Comedy Store in London? Why had you heard about it?
I had watched like stuff from that was recorded there.
All right.
And I knew
on German TV?
On like no VHS, that I had bought. And I read about it and everything. So to me that was the place. It was always the Comedy Store in London and the Comedy Store in Los Angeles that I thought those are the places.
Right. So that first 2009 Edinburgh went okay.
Yeah, it went quite well, yeah. And then I decided after that, and I had no plan, I just quit my day job. And then I went to London after that, straight to London. I was kind of being homeless. I had no place.
Yeah.
And I went to London and I did couch surfing at the comedians' places that I had just met.
For how long?
A couple of months, yeah. Maybe 3 months, maybe.
Yeah.
And I started doing open mics and little spots. And then at one point made some money to pay my rent.
Uh-huh.
I had savings from the other job. And then, yeah, that's how that was my way into the scene, you know.
So you got back. So you got into the German comedy scene through the UK, even though you're German.
Yeah, I started doing gigs in Germany 4 years after I went to London. Yeah.
And which language do you prefer to perform in?
It depends. It's different, I guess. I don't know. I like both. I like to be able to do both. Because then it kind of one feeds the other, you know, which is nice.
The other day I saw a TV commercial over here in Britain. I saw a TV commercial for a German product, Alpecin shampoo. Have you guys heard of Alpecin shampoo? Yeah, it's quite popular now. They're promoting it over here. And the slogan they're using to promote that German shampoo brand did make me laugh. Here's the slogan, you might have heard it. Alpecin shampoo. because 10 million Germans can't be wrong. Historically, maybe not the best slogan to use. That's what I'm trying to say.
When you're writing a joke and you're thinking of the joke in your head, are you thinking of the joke, wherever you're going to tell it, is the thought in your head in German or in English?
So that's different. Some jokes in German, some in English. In my notebook, it's very mixed.
All right.
Do you write different stuff for Britain than for America?
No.
But you do a lot of topical stuff.
I do. I try to.
And that normally... Like,
it's only because I'm old and I want to seem relevant. That's part of the reason.
Right,
it's
right.
True. It's because I'm 57 and I'm like...
People who want to seem relevant often seem desperate.
Yes, there's that.
That goes hand in hand.
Interesting, so I brought up Margaret Cho because she told me years ago... I did, when I started, ask a lot of people advice. And to me, the funniest people I knew were female. Mm. I grew up watching funny women on TV and in films. In America, all the big comics...
Yeah.
I've talked about this on the show before. All the big comedians were female. The funny part of the show... The men were always the straight men, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And there's a long list of those shows I won't go through right now. But when I met Margaret, she and I kind of started around the same time, although she skyrocketed really quickly. Mm. And I would still see her on the circuit in San Francisco, and I would ask her things, because we shared a car sometimes. She had a car.
Oh,
it's a sexy language.
Is it? Even when she said that we're stopping because of construction?
I don't know what she's saying.
Okay.
But we're on a train in Germany going from Berlin, as I said, to Düsseldorf with Christian. And... every time we stop, the Germans bark instructions at us because that's how the whole problem started a while back. But anyway, they have a lot of boundaries and instructions, and we like it. I think she sounds like she just kind of woke up. It sounds nice.
Yeah, she sounds...
Like the woman we're traveling with who's organized today.
Yeah.
Even though she fucked the whole thing up. She's great. I love her. And she might have been a friend of ours. She did. She fucked the whole thing up. And she's wandering around the train station like, I don't know what train we're on. I'm like, are you from here? You grew up here. She's great. And she's very... Her accent's very... She sounds like she's lying in bed when she's talking to us. And her eyes are very sleepy. I think she's sexy. It's great. But anyway, and my mother really influenced me as a comic. My mother had a very... a broad sense of humor, my mom. She always surprised me. My mom could tell a great joke, but she could also, like you said earlier about the tooth, my mom could take her tooth out, her dentures out of her face with her tongue and scare the shit out of us and make us laugh. So my mom was just...
the other way around, right? Normally, like quite often comedians had, or still have, a depressed mother.
Yeah.
And they became a comedian because they tried to make the mother laugh because she was so depressed. And I know so many comedians say like, I've all my life I've had a depressed mother.
Oh, right.
And that's how I developed a sense of humor because I was the one who had to make her laugh, you know?
Well, my mom definitely had her bouts, but I think that she and my brother and sister and I were very close when I was much younger because my father left when I was 2. And then my dad kind of disappeared for a while and married somebody else and had a different family around the corner from us, but just didn't show up.
You said he disappeared for a while, so he came back.
He did. He showed up when my half-brother was 3 with a kid in the back seat of the car and said, that's your half-brother. Oh,
wow. Okay.
So for those few years, my mom was, without a high school diploma, was looking after 3 kids on her own. And she did a decent job, I think. But also what we had to do was develop something. We had a common language, the 4 of us. And we had to develop some way to get my mother's attention. And the way to do it was to make her laugh.
Right.
And my sister's, my husband who's sitting across from us will not agree. But my sister has a very good sense of humor. And she's a good laugher, my sister. And my brother's very funny. And they both believe, you may suffer this, John, if you have siblings, talk about this soon, that they're much funnier than me. And my aunt, who will run, she's threatened us many times, will run around the country shooting each other if they don't stop talking to her rudely. And my family's, they're very funny. My dad's a great joke teller, as distant as my father can seem. I'm from
Same here.
Very humorous family.
My dad, who quite distant, but... Great storyteller and a humorous storyteller.
He wants an audience. Mm. And maybe you inherited that from him, and maybe I did from my own dad.
Hopefully that's the only thing.
Well, there's a couple other things I've since realized as an adult that my father has handed me heretically.
But we become them.
We are them.
Yeah.
We're the only proof they're alive.
Yeah.
Which might be what killed my mother, finding that out. But we're the only reason that they're still around, in a way. And we're, photos aside, we're the only thing that they could show, like, look, I was on the planet.
Yeah.
And
do you think we own anything to our parents? Do we, like...
I don't think they want it. Do you think that they expect something from us?
Yeah, they expect a lot, right? Parents always expect a lot. But I always feel... A lot of people have the feeling they own something to their parents because they owe something to their parents because their parents have done so much for them. Now they owe something. Well, it's really, they have to give something
back.
It's
funny back. You say that, because when I first came over to the UK, I know a lot of comedians, and I still hear this, would not say certain things on stage or on TV that always surprised me that they had boundaries around stuff. And they said, well, I don't want to embarrass my mother.
Yeah.
And I never had that feeling. I don't...
I think it's very important that as a comedian, you have to do your act the same way if your parents are in the room or if they're not.
Yeah.
And you have to be okay with them hearing all your stuff. And yes. To me, I remember that. I remember at the beginning, I was like, what if
you're
my parents were
warm,
here?
Though, on
but
stage.
I still do. For example, I talk about my parents, how they walked in on them having sex. Right? I have a bit about it. And I've done it when my family was in the room.
Right.
And but 10 years before that, I wouldn't have. But then at one point, I was like, no, I need to do the same. I need to be so open on stage that even though I'm likable and I'm warm and all that, you know, you need to do very personal stuff. And you need to talk about your fears and about your fuck-ups and about your family and all that kind of stuff. And about your ex-partners. Mm-hmm. It has to be okay.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be afraid, you know.
I don't have that. And I was always surprised when people had it. Mm. And then I started to... Like you, I started to examine my act and think...
Because they're afraid they won't inherit the house, right?
Well, there's... I think that they... I think that some comics have a real fear of being embarrassed.
Right.
And I think comedy is embarrassing. I think what we do is awkward and creepy.
And you expose yourself.
You do. Mm. But I did have to look at my act after I met British comedians when I first started coming over to the UK in the mid to late 90s and think... Maybe I'm lying. Maybe I'm not as honest on stage as I think I am. What am I actually not talking about? Is there something I'm not covering because I'm worried that my mother will be offended? So I asked my mom, is there anything you mind me talking about on stage? And she said, I don't care what you see on stage. I can't even hear you. She said, when I watch you, all I'm concerned with is how your hair looks, and it always looks nice.
Right.
So when my mom, she would literally come see me, and after set, she'd be like, she'd fix my hair. And I would think, is she not hearing me? And then she told me that she wasn't. That she was more concerned with how I appeared. This is my family. So we talked earlier the other day about how I think I'm superior to the audience and I'm thin.
Yeah.
And I'm from a family where if you gain a couple of ounces, I said this the other night, I mean, they don't pass you the gravy of the holiday. You hear about it.
Right.
And
but because I said, when we talked about this, I said that you need that high status in the room. The highest status in the room has to be yours because of your act, because of the material.
It's a high status
do.
Act, it is.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
You wouldn't, I think if you looked like a bit out of shape, people wouldn't forgive you for what you say.
That's interesting. But I do feel as though, like I see comics wearing shorts and flip-flops on stage and they get away with it. I can't. I feel like any chance I have to try to embrace my authority. I cannot give up any of my authority on stage. I have to, I don't mean dress up, but I have to have a certain, I have to be, there's a certain armor I wear, which I wish I didn't have to. And we were talking about some comedians earlier on this train ride who have, it seems as though, abandoned their acts to become sort of social media activists and have let go of what they thought was funny or even being funny. And put on this hard shell. I sometimes feel like I'm protecting myself more than I'd like to on stage.
But isn't that what you said earlier, that people try to be relevant rather than funny? So it's like, no, I think the job of a comedian is to be funny.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
That's the number one goal. And quite a few comedians want to be relevant.
Well, I think I want to be both, and
right.
Because I think you're not thinking about that. Well, you're not worried because you're still young. You're 40. You said on stage, and that to me sounds young. That's about my husband's age. I'm much, much older. I'm 57. And so I think as you're inching toward retirement years, you start to realize as you look at the audience, they're still your age, your audience mostly, around your age, really.
Right.
But now when I look out, at my husband's club especially, where he works at Top Secret.
That's a very young audience.
They're very young. But that it can be that way sometimes. And I don't want them to... When I first came over to the UK too, I was talking about the US a lot. And one night someone yelled to me, "You've been in the US too much, mate," from the audience. And I thought, they're right. What interests them?
It's about them, right? So I always feel like it's so important. You have to be able as a comedian to talk about yourself for 20 minutes, 40 minutes, 1 hour, whatever, but make it seem as if you're only talking about them.
Of course, or else they're not. Why should they listen to some stranger?
It has to be relevant.
You've got to try to get it right.
And relatable, yeah.
Yeah. If you can just go to a town like where we're going tonight and tell one or two jokes locally, fed those jokes, the audience really responds. It doesn't have to be a great joke, but just something where you recognize where you are and what they're going through.
Ask a question. Say, what is it like here in Düsseldorf? Tell me about it. You know, so you seem interested. even though you might not be interested, yeah, you seem interested, you know, and that's kind of like, that makes them feel comfortable with you.
I don't want it to feel like it's a seminar. I want them to feel like they're in the room, like we're all in the room.
I always think people don't want to have the feeling that they could have watched a recording of this. They want to have the feeling this is just here and now, and I'm lucky to be here tonight, because it's better than last night or tomorrow night.
Well, they
we
should.
Get lucky. It's very unique.
And they should get that feeling because they've paid, they've hired a sitter, they found a parking space. It should be unique for them.
Well, people don't have kids anymore, right?
Yeah,
so well, no babysitters.
Hopefully not. But that's the one thing that I find, I've had this idea in my head of, like, what do I find offensive? Mm. And that's the one thing I do find offensive, is this sort of cynicism in performers where they're just going through rote.
Yeah.
Like, they're not around where they're around. Mm. And the circumstances of whatever's happening in that room, instead of feeding off that, they're being annoyed by it.
It's a rehearsed act that could have been.
Yeah. And I wonder, why are you even bothering with this?
Do you have any taboos that you don't talk about on stage?
Is there? I can't think of any.
So I want to say this on the podcast, because obviously there's quite a few of your fans listening.
Yes. Quite a few.
And I said this to you yesterday, like after the Grenfell Tower disaster in London, which is now 2 years ago, is it? 3 years ago?
It'll be 3 years this summer, won't it?
Okay. We gigged together, I think, a few days after that, a week later maybe. And you did, basically, out of those 20 minutes that we always get on stage, you did around 15, I would say, on Grenfell. And when you went into it, I was...
For those of you listening to the show, you may not know, Grenfell Tower was a block of flats in London that burned...
Social housing.
Yes.
And a lot of people...
It was like a very high...
Low-income people.
Yeah, low-income, or minority, or migrant workers, people that might seem invisible in the mainstream British culture, died.
And they lived in this multi-million or probably billion-dollar or pound project. And somebody made a lot of money off the whole situation of putting cheap cladding on it.
Yes.
And then that kind
of... fire just ran up the building before the firemen could get there. And then there's some disagreements amongst the fire people about how to handle things.
Right.
And that ended, the result of the entire evening, it happened at night, which just made it, for some reason, especially terrifying on film. But
yeah, and dozens of people died.
A lot of people.
And
it was a big deal.
It was an open wound in the British soul, I would say, for like a week. And everybody was really upset, obviously. And it was like the media, that was the only thing on the media.
Yeah.
Now, we gigged together a week later, and you went into it. So you kind of like mentioned Grenfell Tower, and you could feel the entire audience was like, no, he's not going to. No, not after the first jokes he's done now. He can't. This style doesn't really work for
this. Won't work. And he's American. How dare he come here and criticize our fire?
And then and everybody thought, now after you did the first joke about Grenfell Tower, everybody's like, oh, now he's just, you know, that was way too far, too far. And then you went even further.
Yeah, the open casket joke.
Yeah, and more and more and more. And it was just so good because everybody was uncomfortable, but still couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah.
And that was just so good, so brave and so good. And so you did exactly the right
but
thing.
But I knew that if I wrote jokes about it, which I had done, I could only tell them for a short period of time. Because after a few months, it just seemed like, by that point, it'd be like, why are you talking about this again? It's not funny anymore.
But it was so brave.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's just the job. It's our job. Like when Diana died, I was hosting a panel show then for Anglia TV. So we had to get on a bus and go up to fucking Norwich every Sunday to record the show. And on the way up, I wrote a bunch of dead Diana jokes. And the producer said, you're not going to tell these, are you? I said, yeah, I'm going to tell them to the audience before we start the taping to warm them up. He said, you think that these are going to warm them up to you? You've got to host it for 2 hours with three comedians on either side of you telling jokes about another thing. I said, it's the only way to warm them up. It's how I work. So I did it. And they were upset, but I mean, some people laughed. And then on the way out, I had to shake the hands of the 200 people come. It's not to see me, but to see the taping, because there's nothing else to fucking do on Sunday Norris. And a couple women said to me, you know, we liked you, except for those Diana jokes. And I said, I think you like me because of them. And I think you'll realize that and I'm wrong about that, obviously. Mm. But in my mind, I thought the only way to ingratiate yourself, this is why, like my husband says, I have a fucked up brain. Because in my head, I think the only way to let the audience know that you're in there and that you're with them and that you respect them is to write jokes about what's going on right now.
Right.
Otherwise, like we talked about just a few minutes ago, it's just, you're just repeating some shit you wrote a year ago. And I do tell old jokes sometimes and get caught for it.
Right.
And that's the worst feeling I have, is if someone says, you told that joke last time I saw you. That is soul destroying for me.
Yeah,
and it's happened very recently.
Yeah.
And I had to sit alone in a room. It happened at Leicester Comedy Festival the other night. Someone tweeted after the show that you told that joke last year and tweeted the joke.
Mm.
He was wrong, actually. But it fucking killed me that I don't want people to be offended by. That's the cynicism I'm talking about. That's offensive to me.
Right.
To me.
Mm.
I want it to be.
But also, like, when it comes to like really edgy jokes, I think we always forget that people do those jokes when they're in private, you know.
So of course they do.
Diana dies, and half of the country will joke about tunnels and about paparazzi and all that, you know.
Of course.
And but they think it's okay because you're in private. But now they think it's not okay to do it on a stage, you know.
Listen, when you work with kids with intellectually handicapped kids, like I worked with when I was in high school, I volunteered for kids in the summer. And I worked with a lot of retards. I mean, every kind of retard you can possibly imagine. And they fucking love you. And they were all over me because I'm a young guy and I was tall. And they loved the younger thing. I this girl used to hump my leg at school, at work, every day. She ran.
Do
up
you have a number?
Anyway, so I worked with all these guys every summer, and I, you know, it was great. And you would go in the lunchroom at lunchtime. In a hot June or July in California, and you had to let it rip. The teachers would joke relentlessly about these kids. They had to.
Of course,
it's the only way you can go out then, a half hour later, and deal with them.
Of course.
Because you can imagine what a day with kids with handicaps, intellectual handicaps, is like. Mm. I mean,
and like for example,
kids are bad enough.
Yeah, I do a joke for example about, like, I don't know, Nazis or the Holocaust or whatever, you know, and people don't get upset. People find it funny.
You own it.
And then, yeah, and then later, but even in Germany, right? Like, and then later, the same set, I do a joke about Michael Schumacher, right? And people, I don't
explain who Michael Schumacher is.
Well, the former German Formula One driver.
Right, who's got a little head injury.
Very successful, little bit of a head injury. Yeah. When skiing, you shouldn't go skiing in your 40s or 50s. Yeah. It's just, you know, stop when you're
bad
young.
Bad idea, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I do this joke about him, and then people get upset after that joke, and they think I went too far with the joke, because you can't joke about a 7-time Formula One world champion.
He might agree with you on that. My right. Husband's a bit obsessive about him. But yes, yes, yeah.
And then again, everybody in this audience, everybody will have at one point joked about him having a ski accident. Yeah. At one point. But they think it's not okay to do it on stage, you know?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, maybe you get away with Sonny Bono died that way too. Maybe you can make fun of him because he's not so admirable. He's a TV star from the US. Sonny and Cher, he produced Cher, which. But yeah, I know. I mean, it's funny. It's weird, because sometimes I'll tell a joke and people will get mortally offended in the audience. And the offense will kind of spread like a ripple through the room. And I'm like, that's where you draw the line? Yeah. It was so weird. In Leicester the other night, I was doing a solo show at the Leicester Comedy Festival. And I went on stage and I told my first joke about some a pedophile joke about Prince Andrew. And they liked it. And then I continued with something that was new about why I married my husband. And they got quiet. Oh, okay, that's where the pedophile. It's just, you never. But that's what I think is exciting about live performance, is the whole audience should be on pins and needles. They don't know what's going to happen next. They should never know, and neither should we.
Yeah.
It should be something different every time. And that's why when I write new stuff, even if it's not fresh or even if it's not tried and tested enough, I'll open with it, which you should. Young comics, don't open with new material, but I will do it. Because I'm afraid I'm going to forget it. But also, it inspires me.
I always do it second.
Really?
I do when I want to do new stuff in a regular environment like that. I do one thing that's safe. Just,
all right.
But just to give them the feeling that I'm funny.
You can tell a joke.
And they can trust me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then I feel like they relax, and then I can do the new stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I can still remember it. So my brain is able to remember it.
Because it's early on.
Step 2. Step 7, it will be gone.
Yeah.
But I write stuff on my hand. Do you write on your hand?
I did. I wrote four things on my hand last night, and I did them while I wanted to remember them.
About the palm of your hand. I write it on the back of my hand.
Yeah, I see people do that. I don't do that because the audience can see it when I'm holding the mic.
Yeah, but I talk about it, address it.
That's good. Mm. Yeah. Again,
Stuart Lee does it on TV, right?
All right. I'm always worried about my authority. I want them to think that I've been rehearsing and I'm ready.
Yeah, but
I'll do it at the end, and I have a joke about that at the end, but not at the beginning, because at the beginning I want them to think that I'm
you're untouchable, right?
The first time I saw Julian Clary live, Julian Clary's a British comedian, he's brilliant, and I thought this he's tall and statuesque and beautiful and openly gay and very camp on stage, and he's an icon in the UK and abroad. I've worked with him abroad, but I remember seeing him the first time before I started working with him and thought he is the smartest person in the room. And that's one of the reasons why he can get away with some of this outrageous stuff he says. And it just made me think.
Well, Al Murray, the same thing, right? Al Murray plays the pub landlord character, a drunk guy, super smart
guy.
But
he is super smart as well.
Yeah, extremely smart, yeah. A phenomenal comedian, phenomenal. Yeah. And like great.
Sings and dances, does the whole thing. It's a variety show when he performs.
Yeah,
incredible.
And his crowd work is just
unbelievable.
Unbelievable. The way he interacts with them, fantastic. But also people who don't really know him or don't know much about comedy, they watch him in the beginning, they think, oh, that's funny, he's like a funny pub landlord, you know? And then 10 minutes in, he talks about ancient history and what this and that, really complex
or
stuff.
Or bisexuality, and they're like, what?
And I don't people are like, oh, wow, hang on. I don't know what this is, but it's, wow, it's impressive.
He's a brainiac. But also, we were talking earlier, also off the recording, about people's responses online to comedy. There's a comic in the UK. Well, it's all... there she goes again. She woke up from her nap.
Hanover now, where the royal family is from.
There you go. Right. But you. But they're not powerful in Germany. They don't have any...
No, I mean, like, they're in Britain now, right? So.
Well, they seem to have a sway in the UK.
Yeah, they might be coming back. But there's no royalty in Germany left. And if there is royalty, they're poor now.
Oh, good.
So we don't want them.
Poor would be better.
Yeah, thanks to the French Revolution, it's all best for now.
See, honey? It's nice. Yeah.
Hanover is a nice town. It's very underestimated and underrated. It's really nice.
No, they talk about it in Hogan's Heroes a lot, Hanover. They bomb it a lot in Hogan's Heroes.
Right.
Which is a TV show in the U.S.
Okay. Where,
set in a concentration camp, and the war is a sitcom.
Okay. Yeah, there were quite a few concentration camps around here.
Yeah.
But that's not really what I wanted to talk about.
All right. I know the Germans like to avoid that. But anyway, so Mick Ferry got in trouble recently on Facebook, just a little day or two ago, about...
Great comedian, Mick Ferry.
Brilliant, yeah. Genius, and a lovely man. And he said, I mean, I think he's a real... I don't think he's just a brilliant comic, or that he's just admired and loved by audiences, but comics themselves within the business find him as well, like one of the best performers in the UK and abroad. But anyway, he's very well-respected. And he said... Such an innocent remark on Facebook, because there's a Facebook page that provides comics with work. You could just sign up if you see a gig that you want.
Yeah.
And someone on this page had asked for a female comic, and Mick put a comment in saying, I'll wear a dress. And it's had a lot of negative kickback about that from male and female comics, saying, how dare you, and that's
sexist.
And
if you've met or have seen Mick Ferry, you would agree that it would be great to see him in a dress.
Yes, because he's built like a bulldog. And but also it's like... It's like he also bends over backward in his act to be fair.
Yeah.
In a very funny way. There's nothing sexist about McFerry's act. And if there was, it would be hilarious and there would be a reason for it. But anyway, and some of the response, obviously, that I've read on Facebook has been from young comics who don't know shit. But so, and the point I'm making is, what do you should we just be allowed to say what we want? Or is there a... Should there be a boundary or a level or a limit? And when you're performing live, do you self-edit? People think the comics don't. They think that everything we say, we mean, and we believe, and we just have free form, that we do a line of coke, have a drink, hit on a waitress, and then walk out on stage.
Right. But this whole, it's called woke movement, isn't it? Like, the whole thing is, to me, it's about...
Kid doesn't shut the fuck up, I'm going to kick it in the cunt. Anyway, keep talking.
It's been like this for 2 hours, right? The kid is screaming.
Little fucking piece of shit.
Just feed him.
Yeah. Or don't.
Yeah.
Just let him pass out.
Or just let him get off in Hanover.
Yeah.
I think people shouldn't discriminate against other people, but people can still offend other people. And I think if you do a comedy show and nobody gets offended, it was a boring comedy show.
Yeah.
But if you discriminate against people, that's not okay. So, or if you discriminate against everybody, then that's fine again.
I walked 7 in Leicester. 7? Out of 90, that's a lot.
No, it's all right.
But they've paid to come see me. Why are they walking out of
But they still paid.
That's true.
Who cares?
They Three stay. Of them were old, though. They might have only paid discount tickets. Old fucks. Three of them at once.
But still, per minute that they saw, they paid more than anybody else in the room.
That's true. God, the Germans are good with numbers. Anyway, and good at making them up, too. So, you're saying if people aren't offended that you haven't done your job in a way, for some comedians at least.
Yeah, I feel like if I haven't offended anybody, then I think that was a bit dull.
I've been watching you this week, obviously, and then I've seen you many times. I really love your work. And I think, like I told you last night...
Thank you.
But I think after I watched you last night, and my husband's seen you many times at his club, where you've been very successful, the Top Secret Comedy Club in London, which is fantastic. And a Comedy Store, I've seen you there. We've done weekends together, and you're amazing. And every time I watch you, I think, he's both snarky and warm. It's a brilliant combination. Because you do this bit in London, which is so good, about trains, which I won't go into. You've got to see it. But about the way the British have built their trains in a very strange way compared to the way the Germans have built theirs.
Right.
And it's such a touchy fucking subject with the British. Mm. Especially when the Germans start talking about Britain. It's so funny because they're still resentful about what happened. So, I mean, some of them are. I mean, if they're cool, they're not. But they could be if you push them the wrong direction. But you do it in such Oh, it's such a precise, I know saying that to a German is stereotypical, but it's such a precise formulation the way you've got it. And the way you smile and you got a bit of a wink-wink in your eye, the way you're doing it, the whole criticizing the way they build trains and the way the Germans do it perfectly. But you don't say that. What you say is the Germans do it right. Anyway, so it's great.
Oh, thanks,
and I'm watching the whole time thinking, oh, he gets away with this and he's so warm. I mean,
it's a backhanded compliment.
It is. Mm. Which the British are also good at too, but yeah. but you're better at it.
Wow, okay.
And when I watch, I mean, I think I have a little bit more leg room with the British because I'm American, so they feel a certain affinity toward Americans so that they might not feel toward the German culture. They might have just less familiarity with German culture.
Yeah, they know less about
Germany. So when you're doing it the whole time, I'm like, are they going to turn on it? And but there's a great warmth about what you do, and I just, do you feel that you must include a bit of warmth in your act?
I feel like thank you first of all for the lovely words, and I feel when I walk on, also when I watch other,
I'm going to try to find that bit on video if I can, I think, and play it for listening.
I think there might be a clip of that
if I can. I'll ask you for it, but we'll play it for them so they can hear it. But anyway.
even little things in this country make me laugh, you know, like train announcements make me laugh. They in other countries they're just factual, here they make you laugh, at least they make me laugh, you know. You've all heard this one. I'm not sure it's intentionally funny, but every time I hear it, it puts a smile on my face. If you've traveled on a British train, sorry, you look very posh, that's a vehicle for poor people. So, you might have heard this announcement. It goes like this.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to get off this train at the next station, make sure you're traveling in the middle part of the train. Because at the next station, the platform is shorter than the train.
What? What happened there? Who made that mistake, you know? Fuck, man, it doesn't fit.
It's just too short, man.
Again? I think we have to make all the platforms a bit longer, don't we? But that's way too expensive. Let's just make the announcements longer. That's going to sort it. That's probably going to be a good solution. That's not even the best train announcement. Obviously, the most famous train announcement is also the best one. It's iconic. Tourists love it. You see Chinese tourists walk around, you know, Leicester Square with T-shirts and baseball caps with the most iconic train announcement in the world printed on it. Mind the gap, exactly.
Mind the gap.
That's the best one, is it?
Mind the gap.
Every time I hear it, it puts a smile on my German face. Every time. Because that would never happen in Germany ever. The German equivalent of that announcement would be,
ladies and gentlemen, we're very proud to announce that due to perfect engineering... there's no gap.
But I feel, I guess, it's crucial how they see you when you walk on. And yeah. I try to look likable and warm, because, and then build up something nice in the beginning, so that then later on I can do, you know, edgier stuff. And a bit, well, I think ideally do some outrageous stuff that still looks like, it's all right. It's all right. He doesn't really, you know.
Yeah.
We're fine.
See, I try in my head to do that too, but honey, am I warm on stage?
Sometimes.
Oh, this is my husband.
But it's not, you know, I wouldn't say you're warm, it's different. You look invincible on stage, which is great for your act. You look like
I look like they're gonna bite their head off, is what I look like.
No, but in a friendly way, you look invincible. That people are like, there's no way we can damage this guy. We can't do any harm. Heckling will not work. It's like, you know, one of those spaceships that has a shield around it.
I've landed from Pluto, and there's nothing we can say this Martian.
But also, you people would love to get to know you. I think that's always crucial when you see a comedian, and there's some comedians who haven't had the success that they would like to have had, and they always wonder why. And I think it's often that people see the comedian, I think the comedian is funny, the act is funny, but I wouldn't want to know the person. I wouldn't want to have a drink with the person or an ice cream or whatever.
I haven't had ice cream in 17 years. Do you eat ice cream?
I love ice cream.
Oh god.
And
it's amazing, you're so thin you can eat ice cream. I'm so envious. Honey, we don't eat ice cream anymore, do we?
Yeah, Brazil has good ice cream, right?
Yeah, Brazil has great ice cream. Oh my god!
But I feel like if people like you as a person and they want to get to know you, for example, in your case, they would like to know: is he really like this? Does he really mean this or not? Because then you're never sure when you watch. I think as an audience member, you watch Scott Capurro, you're like, how much of this does he mean, and how much of it is just, you know, just for the effect? And like, and then you're like, I don't mean it. Yes, I do. I don't. Yes, I do. That's the feeling.
I don't want them
get.
To know.
Yeah, it's great.
But
so well.
Oh, thank you. Well, what's been happening a lot lately is people may ask me after, women asking me after the set. This has happened more than once. It's happened a number of times recently. if I'm actually gay. And one woman was furious. And that story about that what happened to the Glee in Birmingham was true. She ran backstage and just started screaming at me.
But people ask me, are you really German? You know, like I do a 1-hour show in Britain that's called whatever, you know, Attack of the 50-Foot German Comedian or whatever. And I talk about it being German, all that. It's do it all in this accent, you know. And then later they say, yeah, but where, it's a good act, you know, good show. But where are you from? You're Irish, aren't you? It's, you know, I can hear it through, like a little, you know. And it's like, come on, guys.
You're
really
Irish.
Yeah.
Weird. Yeah, right.
There she is.
She's back.
She's hitting on us. She does. She wants it. The German bitch wants it, honey.
I think it's only us who get the sexy announcement. The other compartments. We paid a bit extra for that.
Yeah. Oh, look, a Volkswagen symbol, honey. The Germans don't let you forget, right? They gave up on the bug again, though. The bug is over. The little one.
It's coming back.
Really?
At one point, yeah.
I hope so. Maybe they do that, just come back.
Yeah. Just keeping it fresh.
Well, I hope we have fun in Düsseldorf tonight.
It's going to be great. It's the first time we're doing this show in Düsseldorf.
So, oh, right.
Yeah, we're now like...
So you've never performed in Düsseldorf before?
I've performed there in German, but we've never done this English night.
All right.
Because just for the people maybe who are interested, we do a regular English night at the biggest comedy club Germany has. In Berlin, 5 times a year. That's what we did last night and the night before.
Right.
And we're now going to Düsseldorf because that show is branching out to Düsseldorf in the very west of Germany.
Let me finish, actually, before you continue.
It's going to be hard to.
But why Düsseldorf? Why did you choose that town to branch out in with English comedy?
She's hot.
She's
flirting. I can tell she's smiling while she's saying
it in English now.
The ICE
right.
To Düsseldorf.
Düsseldorf.
It's funny because then she told us like 5 minutes of stuff in
German, and then 2 seconds
and now in English she's just like,
oh, she goes in German again. It's like a comedy sketch when they do that interpretation thing with
her. Oh,
yeah. This might not make the edit, this part. Maybe she wants to be famous. She must be a comic. Is she promoting her shows right now in German?
She's doing a tight 7 minutes.
I'll be in Stuttgart on April 20th and in Munich April 22nd. All right.
Yes. She's oversharing.
Yeah, it's too long to the punchline. She's got to cut some of this.
Yeah.
So, anyway, go back to what you were saying. So these English-speaking shows started in Berlin and you're branching them. But why did you choose Düsseldorf to branch out?
Quatsch, the comedy club in Berlin, they have a couple of other rooms in Germany and Düsseldorf was the first one to go to. I don't know why.
But I mean, there are a lot of English speakers in Düsseldorf?
I think so, yeah. There's a lot of Japanese in Düsseldorf, yeah. Come on.
She's great. Anyway, what's your future plan for yourself? Where do you want to go? You said you're writing another book. Plug your book.
I'm writing a novel now. The first one was non-fiction. Now it's going to be fiction.
Let it finish first. Okay, go ahead. So
she's not done, is she?
Yeah, she's done. Okay. I heard her turn the thing off. So yes, the first one was non-fiction about your travels in the UK as a comic.
Yeah, yeah. And now the second one is going to be a novel, and it's about to be finished.
I guess. Oh, good.
And I'm doing the usual, touring in Germany, touring in Britain. I'm doing a lot of solo shows in Germany, and I'm doing a lot of club nights in the UK. I'm doing the Edinburgh Festival. You know, trying to be...
What's the name of your show at the Fringe this year?
I don't know yet.
All right. Is that the name of the show?
That's the name
of the show. Okay, right, okay.
You're not going up this year.
I might. I don't think so.
What's the name of the show that you did in Leicester?
It's called Scott Cabral Explodes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you explode?
I did. I lost it a couple times.
At what point during the show did you
explode? Well, after a woman stood up, and beautiful, statuesque woman, and stormed out and slammed the door really loud behind her. That's after those three ladies left. And that's when I lost it. And then her husband
got up. Is she part of the show? Was that...
Well, she wanted to be. And then her partner, husband, got up and kind of sheepishly walked out. And then her friend walked out with the coats. Oh, my God. What is she...
She's saying
this
that
better
in case
be
you're recording a podcast, I want to be on it.
Oh, anyway. So, yes, it was boring. It's boring. But anyway, I did explode. Well, I might explode tonight, maybe. It's a little explosion. Just mini explosion.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Christian, and good luck with your work. We appreciate it. And tune in next week, everybody. We might have somebody else on. So thanks for tuning in to Scott Capurro Probes. And if you're listening to this and you want to see Christian, he'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe this year at the Counting House.
It's not confirmed yet, but let's make it official now.
Let's say at the Counting House.
Yeah.
And he'll
and
be
also,
there.
I'm in London a lot and everything.
Yes, you are.
Store.
And I will be in San Francisco, Bay Area, in March and April doing shows. Check his website, which is...
GermanComedian.com. I can't believe you're asking.
Of course. And
it was still available.
I'm ScottCapurro.com. Welcome and goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.